And we're going to limit our study tonight to two particular aspects of it, the empty tomb and the grave cloths. And to prepare us for this, I've asked that we have four slides, and we'll use these to prepare us. And we'll ask that you turn off the lights now, if you will. And Fred, back there at the back, good. Pictured here is a slide of the city of Jerusalem at the time Jesus was living. The Mount of Olives, due east of Jerusalem, of course, is still there and can be seen. This was where Jesus spent the last hours of his life before his arrest by the mob. He was taken up through where there you see the Valley of Kidron. There's a door just north of the Valley of Kidron that is probably the entrance through which he was taken up an inner passage up here to the house of Caiaphas and Annas. He was then sent to Pilate up at the fortress. You see at the top of the screen where it says the fortress, just below the Jerusalem sign there. That was the pavement where Jesus was tried in front of the Roman tribunal, with Pilate sitting as the judge. He was sent then to Herod's palace over here. Then he was taken back to the fortress and sentence was pronounced upon him. He was led east outside the wall. If you'll see the temple there, the north wall of the temple, just north of that is the Via Dolorosa, the Way of Sorrows. And out of there, he was taken then west to the spot called Golgotha, where he was there crucified, and was then entombed in a sepulcher that was hewn out of stone. And we find that this was the scene of the burial of Jesus Christ, of his crucifixion and his burial. And I show you this to give you some idea about the location of these events that have had such an earth-shaking effect upon our whole civilization. Every event that has happened since this event has been judged as in relationship to what has happened here. All right, show us the second slide now, if you will. This is an artist's conception of the arriving at the tomb of Mary Magdalene, the stone having been rolled back, and she looking inside to see that the body was gone. This startling event, or this startling circumstance, caused her to run to the disciples, especially to Peter and John, and tell them they have taken away the Lord's body, and I don't know where they've laid it. This was the scene as it was pictured here by the artist. All right, again. One of the young girls here in the school, I think her first name is Sarah, but her last name is Sears. I believe it's Sarah Sears. I asked her to draw this scene of the grave cloths, and I'll make further reference to it later. But this represents John as he looks into the sepulcher at the empty tomb, and all that remained there were the grave cloths. And we see a very faint image of one of the men in white as he was sitting down at the other end. There was another one at this end, but that's the scene of John looking into the sepulcher. Then finally, we have the scene of the present day tomb in the city of Jerusalem that is regarded as the traditional site of the burial of Jesus Christ. This tomb was located by excavation by a British explorer, and I'm not sure what the date at which time it was discovered, but when the tomb was discovered, there was no body in it. Whether this is where Jesus was buried, I don't know. This particular site is in a garden. There is a knoll of a hill to the south and east of this burial spot, some 75 yards, overlooking the present-day bus station in Jerusalem. But this particular scene, or this tomb, is there today, and you can, of course, go there and visit it. It's interesting to note that this tomb perhaps is or perhaps is not the local or the location where Jesus was buried. But it was interesting to notice that last week, the Red Square in Moscow had been undergoing refurbishing. And last week, they reopened the Red Square to tourists and anyone who wanted to come and see it one of the things that was costing so much to put back in its original condition was the tomb of Lenin. And that tomb, of course, is occupied. Lenin's body is inside the tomb. It's interesting to me that the very antithesis of what Jesus came and taught and what he was, the man who has led the counter movement against that, being the father or the leader of communism, that he is significantly and very obviously and noticeably in his tomb. Jesus, the one who is the author of all that's good that we know, has from the very outset never been in his tomb after the third day. He's always been recognized as having been away from the tomb or out of the tomb. And I think it presages and previews the actual outcome of what's going to happen in human history. One day, this tomb, as it was empty, one day also Lenin's tomb will be empty. But it will be this one here who has called Lenin to account. And I think it's significant that we are standing on the side of the one whose tomb was empty from the outset. All right, let's have our lights, and if you will, please. Now, I want to make some comments, and I confess at the very outset that there are many subjects that make me feel like I'm trying to cram a cannonball through a pea shooter. This is one of them, and it leaves the pea shooter feeling very insignificant. But let me begin, and we'll work our way through. The two main things I want to tell you about tonight is the empty tomb and the grave cloths. And we'll get there just as quickly as we can. I'll be brief in these introductory remarks, but I want to make some observations that you must see in order to appreciate our present situation. The death of Jesus Christ, the fact that he died, has never been questioned. The fact that he was buried has never really been questioned. The Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, tell in detail of the death of Jesus. Josephus tells of the death of Jesus. I believe there are others. In fact, I know there are others. I didn't get their names because I didn't want to spend a lot of time reading about what they're saying about it. But they all recognize the fact that Jesus Christ died. The death of Jesus Christ, as I say, it is not disputed. And we can grasp the death of Jesus Christ, the event. We know that he was killed under the reign of Pontius Pilate. We know all of this and we accept it. The world knows as much and they accept it. And this is what has been accepted as the actual fact of the termination of the life of this man Jesus who came from Nazareth. Death being a part of our lives, we accept the death of Jesus without question. There's one aspect of the death of Christ, however, that escapes us, and that is the fact that he died upon a cross. But you're saying, why, preacher, I've known that all my life. That hasn't escaped me. No, you don't understand what I'm saying. I say that the death of Jesus being on a cross has escaped you. I don't think you can understand it. I don't believe that we can grasp the meaning of it, the implications of that form of death being by crucifixion, or being by the execution on a cross, you cannot grasp, neither can I. The scourging that preceded it is beyond our comprehension. The whipping of a victim prior to crucifixion is described by John Mattingly in these words. The adjudged criminal was usually first forcefully stripped of his clothes and then tied to a post or pillar in the tribunal. Then the awful and cruel scourging was administered by the lictors or scourgers. Although the Hebrews limited by their law the number of strokes in the scourging to 40, the Romans set no such limitation, and the victim was at the mercy of his scourgers. Eusebius makes the statement and describes it in very graphic terms concerning this Roman scourging. He says that the sufferer's veins were laid bare, and that the very muscles, sinews, and bowels of the victim were open to exposure. Now, this was what it was in preparation for the crucifixion. I don't think we can grasp that. Every one of us sits here tonight and we just simply say yes, but we can't understand it. We have not the mental or emotional framework within which to receive and assimilate and understand the implications of this kind of a death. The crucifixion itself was brutal beyond understanding. It cannot be overemphasized, Mattingly says, that the sufferings endured on the cross were extremely intense and severe. He says, after a sleepless night, Michael Green says, in which he was given no food, he endured the mockery of two trials and had his back lacerated with the cruel Roman cat of nine tails. He was led out to be executed by crucifixion. This was an excruciatingly painful death in which every nerve in the body cried aloud in anguish. It was such a death that the burning pangs of thirst, raging thirst, and all the physical complications caused an internal excitement and anxiety which made the prospect of death itself, of death, the unknown enemy, at whose approach man usually shudders most, it caused death to bear the aspect of a delicious and exquisite release. We cannot understand it. I confess as being number one, I cannot grasp it. This is why I can be led to weep over the story of Lassie, the dog, and sit there and cry tears over the story of a dog cold and bleeding and hungry, giving his life or her life for her master or for his master. To me, I can weep tears over such a story as that, and I bet you can too. And at the same time, those of us who are capable of weeping tears over such as that of a dog find ourselves many times unmoved by the details of the death of Jesus Christ on a cross. Now I ask, what's the matter with you? Well, nothing really, except for the fact that we have this thing of the dog within our own experience, and we can understand that. But the death of Jesus Christ on a cross leaves us unmoved in many respects because of the fact that we cannot understand the extremities of such a brutal death as that. The people back there could. They knew what it meant to die on a cross. You and I don't. Now, I say all of that to say this. We also find ourselves unmoved by the record of the resurrection of Jesus. Just as we many times are unmoved by the extremities of his death, we find ourselves being unmoved in any meaningful way by the reality and by the power of his resurrection. Now, this is true for two reasons. Number one, most of us have been accustomed all of our lives to the teaching of the resurrection. I saw little children at the first service here singing about up from the grave he arose with such fervor. They were just really singing it from their heart. And I thought, that's wonderful. And yet, in a sense, it's not so wonderful. Because many times our only association with the resurrection has been at such an age when we could not grasp its meaning. Little children have difficulty even grasping what death is. And a child who's never seen death, they don't know what death is. Consequently, whenever they hear about the resurrection, they don't really know what the resurrection is either. And we find ourselves being associated with the resurrection at an age and on a certain intake level that we are left without any real genuine appreciation of what it means. And we find that our only association with the resurrection is that, oh yes, that happens at Easter. Oh yes, that's when we get new clothes. Oh yes, and that's when it's too cold to wear the new dress that my mother's bought me. And so we associate it with Easter, with new clothes, and with weather that's too cold to wear the clothes, during which we can wear the clothes. It's too cold. And that's about the extent of our association with the resurrection. The second reason is that the resurrection actually lies outside the realm of our everyday experience. We just simply cannot grasp it because it does not lie within our experience. Though we see the resurrection every year, as we see the turning of the seasons, we in the springtime will see the resurrection. We'll see everything burst forth again in the fall. You see the same thing again in a different sense as you see the seeds that have been planted in the springtime burst forth, but those seeds had to die first before they could be raised up in a new form. This is the same thing. We see this in fact, but we cannot make the relationship or the connection with the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So I say we find ourselves unmoved by his resurrection for these two reasons. We're too familiar with it, and it is a matter that is beyond our human experience. We cannot grasp it. We do not have the mental nor the emotional framework to receive it, assimilate it, appreciate it, and appropriate it. We're left standing here with an intellectual assent to a very momentous occasion which we cannot explain. And because of our inability to assimilate and appropriate, we find ourselves void of its power. Now, don't think that you're standing in a peculiar position. The Apostle Paul, I think, stood in the same position, if not identical, similar. Paul was raised a Pharisee, and the Pharisees have always believed in the resurrection.
Paul was raised in the Pharisee tradition, and he believed in the existence, the reality, or at least in the theoretical possibility of the resurrection. Whether he knew what it meant or not, I seriously doubt. It was looked upon as something in the future, and so, sure enough, he was a Pharisee, raised a Pharisee, he knew nothing else. Secondly, Paul actually saw the resurrected Lord on the road to Damascus. Two things then were perhaps in Paul's favor, maybe one of them wasn't. The fact that he believed in the resurrection, and the fact that he had actually seen the resurrected Lord. And yet that man himself, who had been raised believing in the resurrection, and who had seen the resurrected Lord, makes this very accommodating confession, as he said that what he wants is to know Christ. This is in Philippians, the third chapter. That I may know him and the power of his resurrection, and may share his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, that if possible I may attain the resurrection from the dead. Here we find the man, the Apostle Paul, so wrapped up in this desire to know Jesus Christ in the extremity of his death, his sufferings, and in the reality of his resurrection, his power, that Paul says, and he gives us the impression, that he's actually straining. He says, I want to know him. I want to be united with him. I want to share his sufferings. I want to know him in his death. And I want to be united with him also in his resurrection. I want to know the power of his resurrection. And I think the Apostle Paul was simply stating that though he had been brought up believing in the resurrection, and though he had actually seen Jesus Christ on the road to Damascus and was fully aware of the fact of the resurrection, I still think the Apostle Paul was crying out, Lord, give me the capacity to fathom, to understand, to assimilate, and to appropriate the power of the resurrection. I think that's what he's asking for. And I think, consequently, in view of what Paul says, I feel that it is totally legitimate for me to have this same crying desire. I want to know Jesus Christ in the extremity of his death. I want that benefit. And I also want to know him in the power of his resurrection. I think if Paul could cry out that, let me have this experience, then I think I can legitimately make the same appeal. I want to know Jesus Christ in his death, and I want to know the power of his resurrection. So for that reason, I'm asking that you, and for the last 2 weeks we've studied it, or the last week and for another week and maybe two, we'll study it more. But I want you to see if there's any way possible that we can begin to fathom the extremity of the death of Jesus and at the same time then understand the power of the resurrection of Jesus. Tonight, in order to be concise and boil it down to where perhaps we can grasp it, I want to talk simply about the empty tomb and the grave cloths, but let's go back just a wee bit before we go into the burial, or before we go into the empty tomb and the grave cloths. The preparation for the burial took place about 5 o'clock on this Friday afternoon. Jesus had been on the cross for at least from 12 to 3, during which time there was the darkness over the earth, from the 6th to the 9th hour. And then he, of course, was on the cross sometime after that. We don't know exactly what time he died, but his life expired sometime after 3 o'clock. Joseph of Arimathea, being a secret disciple of Jesus, got up the courage to go in and find out if Pilate would give him the body. Pilate was surprised that the man was dead already. He sent and asked for a soldier who is on guard there and asked him, is the man dead? And the soldier said, yes, he's dead. And so Pilate then gave Joseph of Arimathea leave, and he took the body down. He and another man, Nicodemus, who had come to Jesus by night, these two men, both rich men, took a ladder probably or some mechanism and got the cross up out of the ground, laid it down, took this man off, and then carried him to a place or perhaps prepared him there on the spot. I don't know. But in Mark, the 15th chapter, verses 42 and following, and when evening had come, since it was the day of preparation, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea, a respected member of the council who was himself looking for the kingdom of God, took courage and went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Pilate wondered if he were already dead. And summoning the centurion, he asked him whether he was dead. And when he learned from the centurion that he was dead, he granted the body to Joseph. And he bought a linen shroud, and taking him down, wrapped him in the linen shroud. Then in the book of John, in chapter 19, John records that this man Nicodemus also came and brought 100 pounds of myrrh and aloes, And that was this gum-like substance mixed with this powdered wood, all of which had a tendency and had a property that seemed to embalm, and it seemed also to have a property of causing the clothing to stick to the body so that it would stay wrapped. It said, since it was the day of preparation, in order to prevent the bodies from remaining on the cross on the Sabbath, the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken. And it goes on down, Jesus' legs were not broken. But then in verse 39, it says, Nicodemus also, who had first had come to him by night, came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds weight. And they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen cloths with the spices, as is the burial custom of the Jews. Now this was the preparation that was made. A linen cloth, and Matthew calls it a clean linen cloth that Joseph of Arimathea had bought. He bought the cloth, Nicodemus brought the spices, and together these men wound this body with the cloth and interlaced the cloth with this spice and the myrrh and the aloes in order to provide the burial for this man. And this was the preparation that was made. The burial at that time, and the custom was, that they would wrap the body, perhaps beginning at the feet, and would wrap it up under the armpits, and they would leave the upper shoulders and the arms out, would cross the hands across the chest, and would leave the neck and the face uncovered, and there would be a turban-like band wrapped around his head, and the myrrh and the aloes and all, of course, put in that turban-like band. This is the way they prepared for the burial of Jesus Christ. And as they carried the body, it was not carried in any kind of a casket. Henry Latham gives the following details concerning Christ's burial. We can make out from ancient authorities that the body was borne to burial without a coffin or enclosure of any kind. It was carried on men's shoulders on a bier and was either attired in the ordinary garb, bound round with grave bands in order, perhaps, to keep the spices, or else it was swathed in linen cloths. The face of the body, says Dr. Edersheim, was uncovered. The body lay with its face turned upward, its hands folded on its breast. I believe, judging from existing usage, that the neck and the upper surface of the shoulders were commonly left bare, as well as the face. Now, this is a record of the preparation and of the preparing for the burial of this man, Jesus. They took the body, carried it on their shoulders, probably, to this garden tomb, which was nearby. And the latter part of this chapter of John 19 says this: Now in a place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new tomb where no one had ever been laid. So because of the Jewish day of preparation, as the tomb was close at hand, they laid Jesus there. It seems that they were fighting a clock. The sun was setting. That would have meant that at the setting of the sun, the Sabbath began. That was Friday evening. And so because of a lack of time, they took the body of Jesus, laid it in this tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, where no one had ever been laid before. And they then concluded the burial of this man who had been such a tremendous influence in their lives. A stone was then rolled over it. A round stone was rolled up over the mouth of the tomb to prevent the burglarizing of it by those who made their living by burglarizing tombs. This was witnessed by Mary Magdalene and the other women who were there at the scene of the burial. It says they were over opposite the tomb. In other words, they were more or less looking at it face on as they saw the tomb being closed by the stone. And then they left because it was the Sabbath. They went on back home and rested on the Saturday, which would have meant Friday night on through Saturday up until sundown on Saturday. With the coming of sundown on Saturday, these ladies went to the marketplace or wherever it was necessary to secure such things and bought some more spices and took them then early the next morning, just as it was beginning to break day, to the tomb in order to perfect or to finish whatever preparation they felt was essential to this man's preservation. You see, these people did not expect Jesus at all to come forth from the grave. They had no idea that he was going to. They had prepared him for a continuing burial in a tomb. The Sabbath, however, though it was spent in rest by the Jewish or by the disciples of Jesus, the enemies of Jesus did not spend it in rest. The people who had had him killed went to Pilate and made this statement. Sir, they said, we remember how that impostor said while he was still alive, after 3 days I will rise again. Therefore, order the sepulchre to be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples go and steal him away and tell the people he has risen from the dead. And the last fraud will be worse than the first. Pilate said to them, "You have a guard of soldiers. Go make it as sure as you can." So they went and made it, the sepulcher, secure by sealing the stone and setting a guard. So though the disciples of Jesus rested on the Sabbath, the enemies of Jesus didn't. They made three provisions. They put a stone there. They put a seal of Roman authority upon the stone, and they set a Roman guard there to protect the seal and the stone. There was no way that Jesus Christ could have been taken out of that tomb without the Roman soldiers themselves, of course, knowing it. Now, we come then to the resurrection scene. And I say the resurrection scene because that's all that we have of the record. We're not allowed to go back beyond the actual scene of the empty tomb. That's as far back as we can go. The enemies of Jesus went back a bit further than that. They saw the actual rolling back of this tombstone and of the sitting on the stone of this messenger or this angel from God. That must have been a frightening sight. As though the angel rolled the thing back and then sat down on it. That's adding insult to injury. And I see in this thing the same personality that Jesus had. It's like as though they would say, "All right, Buster, what about this?" And he said he rolled the thing back and then sat on it. And I can imagine him sitting there with his chin and on his fist, you know, saying, "Okay, put this in your pipe and smoke it." But nevertheless, it says that this so frightened these men that they became like dead men. About that time, and the women didn't see this event, the enemies of the Lord saw a bit more than the disciples saw. By the time the women got to the tomb, the stone had already been rolled back. The women went in and looked and found that the body was gone. I don't know whether the soldiers went in to see the empty tomb or not, but I think that whether they did or not, the very sheer, whatever it was that you would call it, the strangeness of all these events taking place, and then the women going in there saying, "Well, where is his body? The body's gone." And maybe the men could see, I don't know. But they got the definite impression. They went back into the city as the women were going to tell the other disciples. The soldiers went back into the city and told the rulers of the Jews all these things that had happened. Then the report of the Jews was this. They understood that the tomb was empty. They gave then these men, these soldiers, money and said, "You say to the people when they ask you, well, you say his disciples came and stole him away while we were asleep." That's ridiculous. If they were asleep, how did they know who it was that stole him? Well, I don't know. I don't know whether they had thought of that one or not, but that's the report that went out. And at the time of the writing of Matthew's gospel, which was probably way on down in the sixth decade of the first century, some 30 or 40 years after the burial and resurrection of Christ, it was still being told among the Jewish people that the disciples of Jesus came and stole him while the soldiers were asleep. And so they incriminated themselves. But nevertheless, we'll not go into all that. But the empty tomb was the cause of the stir. It was never doubted that the tomb was empty, either by friend or foe. And let me say this. I believe with all my heart that the stone was rolled back not to let Jesus Christ out. It was rolled back to let us in. Now, I don't know whether you're aware of that. I don't know what your concept of the stone being rolled back is. But I believe, and from what we have in the records here, that the stone was rolled back not to let the Lord out. He was gone. It was rolled back to let us see that he was gone. And the empty tomb has always been the issue. It's always that which caused the stir. It caused a stir among the disciples. A false stir. Mary Magdalene came and saw that the stone had been rolled back and that the body was gone. She went to the disciples and said, "They've taken the body of the Lord away and I don't know where they've laid him." Well, that wasn't true. That's the farthest thing from the truth. But as far as her frame of reference in her mind, she couldn't grasp anything else. She could not conceive of the resurrection of Jesus. So it causes the stir among the disciples. It caused the same stir among the enemies of Jesus. They were the ones who also were disturbed over the empty tomb. Now, they didn't see the Lord, but they were fully aware of the emptiness of the tomb. And when they went back and told them of all these things that happened, then they reckoned with the empty tomb, and they came to some conclusions about it. But the point I want to make to you tonight is this. The fact of the empty tomb was never in question. That, to me, is the most significant fact. It was never questioned as, "Oh, I don't believe the tomb is empty. Go and check it." They never checked it. Whenever the only two people that we have any record of checking the empty tomb is Peter and John. When Mary came and gave them this false report, they ran back and checked the empty tomb. Now, it is the empty tomb that caused the stir. It is the empty tomb that caused the confusion. It is the explanation of the empty tomb that was the issue. What was the explanation of the empty tomb? That's as far back as you go. In the epistles, in the letters, in the book of Acts, you never find the empty tomb being even referred to. Why talk about something that everybody knew? They were conscious of the empty tomb. It was the explanation and the implication of the empty tomb that caused such a furor. And they couldn't understand it. The enemies of Jesus said the disciples stole him away. The disciples said the enemies stole him away. Was there a third alternative? Well, perhaps. But the question kept being battered back and forth. What is the implication of the empty tomb? What's the explanation for it? Mary was wrong when she said they've taken the Lord's body and I don't know where they've laid it. She was dead wrong. The enemies of Jesus were dead wrong when they put the rumor in circulation that the disciples had come and stolen him away. I asked the question, why in the name of common sense would the disciples have come and stolen the body away? They didn't believe in the resurrection anyway. They were the last ones to believe in the resurrection. I think that the rulers of the Jews were aware of the resurrected Christ before his own disciples accepted it. So the disciples of Jesus were not in any frame of mind to go there and try to perpetrate something that they didn't even believe themselves. It doesn't make sense. You see what I'm saying? Why should they have done it? Why should they also have risked their lives to take a body that was Roman property? It had a seal on it by the Roman government. It had a guard placed there by the Roman authorities. Why would they then risk their lives? They had run from Jesus all before at his death and all. Now you think they were going to go back in and risk being put to death by going in and breaking a Roman seal and taking a body out of a Roman tomb or a tomb over whom the Roman authorities were presiding? It doesn't make any sense. Thirdly, do you think they're going to take a body and go hide it somewhere and then go out and proclaim he's been raised from the dead and then die a martyr's death? Do you think that people are going to do like that? Well, of course not. I don't believe that they'd go out and perpetrate some hoax and fraud and try to circulate a lie in view of the fact that the circulation of that lie was going to cause these people to be put to death. I can't believe that that's just nonsensical. But the empty tomb is what caused all this stir. And when you get right down to it, you'll have to simply say that the empty tomb, all it did was cause a great big question mark to be raised. They didn't know what had happened. And the disciples were more confused about it than were the enemies of Jesus. But we'll just say that that's one thing. The second thing was the grave cloths. The grave cloths are recorded only in John. And the grave cloth record, if you'll go back and read it, has all of the earmarks of having been recorded by an eyewitness. Now, I know the Lord can record something if it's an eyewitness or not. He doesn't have to have an eyewitness to record the truth. But I'll tell you what, I get a real eerie, strange feeling when I read the record in John 20 that whoever it was that wrote this was there inside the tomb and had become very impressed by the presence of these grave cloths. Now, only Peter and John went to the tomb. We don't have any record of any of the other disciples going to the tomb. But when John went, it says he saw the grave cloths. When Peter then came and went inside, it says he saw the grave cloths, that they were there lying, and that the turban was there in a place separate as it was, and it was not with the grave cloths. It was separate in the sense that it was not connected with it. It was separated perhaps by this much. It was in its place as it had been lying there after the resurrection or after something happened. But it was so meaningful. John uses it as evidence that forced him to the belief that Jesus Christ had been raised from the dead. Now, how did it happen and why? Here's how it happened, I believe. You see, John and Peter only had some small bit of information, and it was misinformation. It wasn't even the truth. The only indication that they had as to the explanation of the empty tomb was from Mary. And here she came, like many times women do. She lost all of her composure. She tore out to the disciples and very emotionally said, Oh, they've taken the Lord's body and I don't know what they've done with it. Well, she couldn't have been farther from the truth. But when John and Peter ran to the tomb, the only information that they had was this, two facts or two reports. Number one, the grave was empty. And number two, a false report explaining the empty grave, that they've taken the body of the Lord and put it somewhere else and I don't know where it is. That's all they knew. They approached the tomb with this misconception. that the body of Jesus had been taken by somebody and moved somewhere else. All right, that's the reference, or that's the information that they had. Now you put that in your mind. Let's run with John and Peter to the tomb with this preconceived idea that somebody had stolen the body of the Lord. All right, we look into the tomb, and the first thing that greets us are these grave cloths lying where they were, and the headband there by itself, separate, lying where it was. John looked at these two reports as directly contradictory to each other. Now watch, why was it so contradictory? For this simple reason: the grave cloths lying as they were disproved Mary's claim that somebody had stolen the body. Well, why? Well, let me give you an illustration of it. First of all, I don't know whether you understand what this is talking about in John 20. I didn't either for a long time. The girl who drew this picture of John looking into the tomb, I specifically, and this will give you an illustration of how Jesus couldn't get through to them either, I specifically told that young lady, a lovely girl, but she couldn't comprehend it, I said, now listen, I want you to draw it like it's described here. The description here gives us the impression that the grave cloths were lying there as though the body had just taken leave of it and gone. They were not unwrapped. Now Lazarus had to be unwrapped. Jesus said, unwrap him and let him go. Jesus, this particular scene here, belies that and says that's not the way this happened. These grave cloths were lying there as though the butterfly had gone out of a cocoon and the cocoon was just there. Oh yeah, she said, I understand. And I'm not standing here if I didn't. Whenever she finished it and brought it to me, she said, oh, I've made a mistake. She said, I didn't understand what that was talking about until finally it dawned on me. These things weren't unwrapped off of the body. They were lying there like something had gone out of them and just left them in their place. I said, yeah, that's what I was telling you. But she was so excited, she said, I didn't see that. And listen, she took the thing and erased it and redid it in the form that we see it. That is what so impressed John. John came there thinking that somebody had moved the body of the Lord and stolen it. When he got there and saw the grave clothes, it says he believed. And he had this former evidence, or witness, so to speak, contradicted by the facts. And here the facts are. Number one, if Nicodemus, or if Joseph of Arimathea had taken the body away and laid it somewhere else, he certainly would not have taken the time to unwrap all that and undo the work that he had taken him maybe an hour and a half to do. I don't believe he would have done it. If he had moved the body, maybe from social pressure, you're a member of the Sanhedrin, you're going to let this man's body lie in your tomb? And maybe under pressure, maybe they thought, Joseph of Arimathea did move it, and I don't know where they've laid him. All right. If he did, I maintain that he did not unwrap him. Secondly, if his enemies, or if rather one of the disciples, in planning a subtle hoax on the world, if they had moved him, they wouldn't have risked taking the time to unwrap him either. I don't think they would have unwrapped the body. Thirdly, the very fact of the sheer ghastliness, the sheer horror and dishonor of unwrapping a dead body and carrying that clammy body to some other location is absolutely asinine. It is completely unbelievable. Can you imagine the condition of the body of Jesus, who had just suffered, say, 40 lashes or maybe 50, where his bowels had been made visible and all the sinews of his body ripped off the back of his back? Can you imagine? These grave clothes were holding in much of what was inside the body of Jesus Christ. I can't believe that anybody, whether he was coming to steal it or whether he was just simply coming out of honor and respect, though maybe in some chagrin, to take him and move him somewhere else, I cannot believe that anybody would have unwrapped the body and carried that dead, cold, clammy body without the wrappings on it. It just doesn't make sense. And then you add to it the fact that these clothes were lying there as they were. No wonder John believed it. John got an impression of something. He began to sense, all right, dead bodies only leave in two ways. Somebody either comes and takes it away, or else it gets up and leaves of its own accord. Now, John had enough sense to see that. When Mary came with this false report and said, somebody's come and taken him away, Well, John didn't know what had happened until he got there and saw those grave cloths. And it says that John looked and believed. And he describes the grave cloths in very intimate detail. The grave only caused questions. The grave cloths began to fit the picture together for John, and gradually and very gently, John began to get the idea, yes, I do believe he must have been raised. The question still remains, what happened to the body of Jesus? What did happen? Well, the empty tomb just brought questions. The grave clothes bring us a bit closer, and you're going to have to reckon with them. These are the recordings of an eyewitness. He saw the grave clothes there. How do you explain them? Oh, well, those who came and stole the body, they unwrapped him. I don't believe that. John didn't believe it. There'll be more evidence presented next Sunday night, but I'm just going to leave you with the same question that was in the minds of Peter and John and the other disciples. When Peter and John saw it, you know what it says they did? They went home to their own houses. And I get the impression that they went home scratching their head, thinking, well, I wonder what in the world happened. They were dumbfounded. Now, you know the outcome, perhaps, but I want you to wrestle with it and see if perhaps these two things can perhaps force you to a crossroads in your faith. What did happen? What did happen to the body of Jesus Christ? Did his enemies steal him? Did his friends steal him? Or was he raised from the dead? You need to decide. And I suspect that you're going to have to get your Bibles down and go here and check for yourself. I suspect very strongly, and I say that as an understatement, I suspect very strongly that Jesus of Nazareth, in an unprecedented show of power, knowing him, he came forth from the dead in a manner that did not require him to be unwrapped. He just left. And then the tomb was open so that we might come in and see that they could not hold him. Think about it. Tonight you're being asked to respond, but it's on the basis of the resurrection. If you're asked to respond in belief in faith, in your belief in Christ, it's on his being raised from the dead that makes it valid, and you're being asked to go through a burial and a resurrection that's patterned after his, which is meaningless, and somebody's trying to put you on and have you on. If there was no resurrection, don't let them make a fool out of you by putting you down in water and being and raising you up. And they're asking also, we are, that you live your life in purity and holiness and sanctification. But if there's no resurrection from the dead, you better forget it and get all you can while you're here, because this is all there is. Paul said, if there's no resurrection, then let's live it up. Let's eat and drink, because tomorrow we die. The resurrection of Jesus Christ is the whole basis of it. There's no reason to commit yourself to him if you aren't raised from the dead. There's no reason to live a life of purity unless he was raised from the dead. What do you think about it? John and Peter went home scratching their heads, wondering. But John had begun to see. I believe he must have been raised from the dead. The grave clothes pushed him to that conclusion. What do you think about it? What you think about it will definitely determine what you do about your relationship to Jesus Christ. It's a thrilling thought. He was raised from the dead to a new realm. We ask you to simply wrestle with it and think about it and pray over it and go to these records between now and next Sunday night, and let's see some things that, to me, are such a clinching, reassuring affirmation that Jesus of Nazareth really was raised and that he lives, that I'm anxious to tell you about it. May God bless you in your search for a basis for faith. And if this lesson has helped you arrive there, I'm thankful. Let us stand and sing.